Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology of political life. Now, cabinet ministers and Conservative MPs are in a holding pattern, one might say not for the first time this year, as they ponder what to do about their leader, or PINO, Prime Minister in name only, in other words, Liz Truss. In this week's episode, to help me analyse what on earth is going on, or why it's not going on, I am joined by political analyst and journalist Michael Crick. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Fantastic to have you on my couch, as it were. It's been quite a week, it's been quite a day. With Prime Minister's questions. Actually, yeah, let's start with Prime Minister's questions. How do you think Liz did?
Well, she sort of did all right, actually. It was not a disaster that some people thought, but you were still left with the feeling, gosh, is this woman really Prime Minister? You know, and she's clearly, you know, sadly, it is a sad thing, not up to the job. And, you know, you hear that with virtually every word that she utters. I mean, the people I really feel sorry for are her parents, who are these both sort of left-wing progressive types. I think they're separated now. And just imagine them going along to the local environmental meeting or the local peace meeting, and everybody sort of knowing that they're Liz Truss's mother or father, and sort of, you know, not making eye contact or something. But I mean, she bought herself a bit of time, but you may be talking about hours rather than days, and these occasions are often sort of billed as being, you know, the great showdown, the turning point in somebody's career, and it rarely happens that way.
And the problem for that is, and this is what I've identified, is because the people who could make a decision to make it a make or break moment are the very people who are suffering from what appears to be some form of political inertia. And in my line of work, as certainly in the world of psychology, it's very useful to explore why people delay making a decision, why people procrastinate. And you're absolutely right. Some MPs went public and said, well, let's see how she did. Well, let's see how she does at PMQs. And then you've got the other tribe who are saying, well, let's wait for the statement on the 31st of October, like this Halloween statement. Why do you think there is this delay? Why are they so terrified to act?
Well, I think they're embarrassed. The MPs are embarrassed by how the public are going to take it. It's a bit like if you got married and then you decide within hours or days that it's a dreadful mistake and you shouldn't have married this man or woman. And you can't really announce, you know, after 4 weeks that you're going to separate and get divorced. You sort of, you know, that would just make you look, it would just look awful. And I think there's an element of that it just makes the Conservative Party look so stupid, given the turnover of leaders that they've had in recent years. So it's partly that. Second, I think it's because they don't really know what to do next. I mean, the ideal is that they can somehow, the MPs amongst themselves, a bit like it used to happen in the old days before it went to the members, they can somehow come up with one winner, with preferably no elections at all, not even amongst themselves. But they probably would have to have elections amongst themselves. But can they engineer that and so that it all happens quickly? Because the country can't afford another 6 to 8 weeks while the Conservative Party goes through another leadership election, and you have a you know, an even lamer duck than Boris Johnson was over the summer. So they're trying to get deals and talking behind the scenes to try and bring about that situation. And of course, the real problem is they can't agree amongst themselves who is the next Conservative leader. And it's a matter of politics. It's a matter of whether people are up to the job, and factions, and, you know, who's actually, and indeed, what is the purpose of the next Conservative leader and Prime Minister? I mean, is the next election, you know, lost already? And is it purely a matter of presenting as good a picture to the outside world and turning things round so that the Conservatives end up perhaps with 200 seats rather than 20 seats? But there's all sorts going on in their minds.
That's right. There are so many things going on in their minds, and therefore they seem obsessed with getting more and more information about all those different elements. And that, in my world of psychology, we call that redundant deliberation, that actually you're spending too much time for not enough return of your extra information. But the concrete information that they all do have are the polling results, that actually the gulf between the Conservative Party and the Labour Party is the trend is only going in one direction. And I think there was a YouGov poll out this week that was actually asking Conservative members, and 55% of them said that Truss should resign already. And presumably this includes, you know, many people who voted for her, although I haven't met anybody who actually said, even before this debacle, that they had voted for her. So you would have thought that the polling, being as epic as it is, would actually have concentrated the mind. So at what point do you think, what will the tipping point be?
Well, of course, the polling is only over a very short period of time.
It's only a snapshot of public opinion, as they always say.
Well, it's a series of snapshots, but it's only over 2 weeks. Some of them will be hoping that it's just temporary, that somehow Hunt will come along and come out with his statement on the 31st and all will be well, and the Conservatives, the Labour's lead will be reduced back to, say, 15% or 10%. And that's perfectly manageable, because 10 or 15%, Labour often gets that. Oppositions often get that, and then they lose the next election. So it's a matter of how permanent is the massive 20, 30 plus leads in the polls. Now, my own view is that they are permanent, that they will carry on for the next 2 years, because I think that what's happened in the last 3 or 4 weeks is one of those moments that you get only sort of every 10 years or so in politics, but they really do turn public opinion. 99% of what goes on in politics makes no difference to public opinion. The public probably even aren't aware of most of what goes on in politics. But every now and then, there's some event like devaluation in 1967, which did it for the Labour government in 1970, or Black Wednesday, which did it for John Major's government, even though the economy actually did rather well after that over the next 5 years. But these are moments, generally a financial moment involving the pound and interest rates, where the pound brings a nationalistic element into it. And these are moments that really do swing public opinion, and it's almost impossible to get public opinion back. And I think we've had one of those moments. And
a friend of mine has the distinction between a talking point and a turning point. And a talking point would have been, you know, it could have been Partygate, it could have been Chris Pincher, or any of the other scandals that happened in the last 12 months. But to have an actual turning point that really moves the dial, that, and as you say, often seems to accompany something that really resonates with the public, and that invariably is around money. How much money do I have in my pocket? How much money do I have in my bank account? Is my salary going up or down? That actually, that really focuses opinion and becomes something that is much more seismic, causes a real shift in public mood.
Well, Conservative MPs will be hoping that this is not one of those moments, that it's only temporary, that by early November, everybody will have forgotten the so-called mini budget, and that this will be overridden by whatever Jeremy Hunt announces, and then all will be back to normal. I mean, I think it's fantasy, but some of them will be hoping that. And in the meantime, they hope they can perhaps settle on some alternative, because there is no obvious alternative right now. You know, is it Rishi Sunak? Is it Boris Johnson? Is it Jeremy Hunt? Is it somebody else we haven't thought of? And maybe in that time, the time, you know, talking together at Westminster Monday to Thursday, and then talking in their constituencies Friday to Sunday, they can somehow resolve some of those questions, because they can't make another mistake. The person they choose now has got to be their leader for the next election, and they've got to be a campaigner. And I mean, that's the other thing about Liz Truss. I mean, she is dreadful in the Commons. She's dreadful in press conferences. And can you imagine what she would be like in an election campaign or in campaign debates? I imagine she would try and avoid them all, or in campaign interviews.
I suppose that she'd be under a desk somewhere, no longer in a fridge, but now the hiding place du jour is under the desk. But that's fascinating, isn't it? Because you only have to look at Shakespeare's many plays where you have incredible leaders and they're always great orators. That's why we, you know, even though they've got their tragic flaws, their fatal flaws often, we warm to them because they're so magnetic on stage, because they can really perform and hold an audience. And if we think about the greatest leaders, maybe over the last 50 years, they've invariably been people, dare one say, who can string a sentence together, but in a really charismatic way. And for some reason, some people voted for someone who really couldn't do that. But you mentioned Rishi Sunak there, and I'm reminded again of this polling that came out from YouGov earlier this week, which said that if this summer's leadership election was rerun, over half of the members would vote for Sunak. And I have a question for you about that. Why does the Boris camp insist on seeing Rishi Sunak as the main betrayer and therefore kind of hobbling him as a potential successor to Liz Truss, when it was actually Sajid Javid who resigned first?
Well, I think what happened, if we remember rightly, is that Sajid, there was one evening just before Johnson had to go, where Sajid Javid came out against him publicly, and 6 minutes later Rishi Sunak came out against him, and that did look like you know, he felt he had to catch up. But there was also there's also been a feeling for months and months and months that Sunak has been very slickly organizing a campaign, doing all these videos, many of them paid for by the Treasury, and ostensibly government videos, but frankly they were Rishi Sunak videos. It was all a bit too slick and a bit too arranged. But I do agree, it does seem to me a little unfair when he wasn't by any means the only Conservative or cabinet minister to come out against Boris Johnson. But in these circumstances, people always love a scapegoat, don't they? They always love somebody to blame, just to make sure it's nobody can suggest it's their fault.
Politics is very much about narrative, and it's very much about the stories that get told about people. Well, you know, for the electorate, it's the stories that they tell themselves about their lives and about the lives of people close to them. I think with politicians, it is about wielding that narrative and having the power to say, this is how it really was, and irrespective of whether that's actually the case. And you used a really interesting word just now, which was fantasy, you know, whether the fantasy of what might happen over the next 2 weeks. And what I noticed today was that even though there are many people saying, OK, let's wait for Jeremy Hunt's statement on the 31st of October, you've got other people who are kind of breaking ranks already. You've got William Ragg, MP, who has talked openly about the fact that he has submitted his letter to Sir Graham Brady. And now that Liz Truss has turned the vote on fracking into a motion of no confidence, William Ragg finds himself having to go vote against his instincts so that he can't lose the whip, and therefore his letter into Sir Graham Brady still stands. Now that sounds like Alice in Wonderland politics to me.
Well, there's another factor to it as well, that he needs the whip in order to be vice chairman of the 1922 committee. And actually, he's only 34, I think. And he is already vice chairman of the 1922 committee, and he's chairman of a select committee, which is amazing. You know, there are very few people who are MPs at 34, let alone holding those two positions. And if he was to lose either the whip, he would be deprived of both of those positions. So you can see his problem there. And there will be all lots of little calculations like that. And of course, if you lose the whip, you can't be a Conservative candidate at the next election either. And the danger is the party goes ahead and chooses somebody else in the meantime. And of course, all those people in the autumn of 2019, in that big, the whole Brexit crisis at the start of the Johnson government, but before the general election, there were a whole load of people who lost the whip there and never did manage to fight the 2019 election. So there's all these considerations, and the consideration of how it's all going to go down with your constituency association at a time when the boundaries are all about to change. And what the party is trying to do nationally is organize it so that, okay, Bob, well, you've lost this bit of your seat, but don't worry, you can keep the seat, and Jim will be there and Jill will be there, and you'll all have to move around a bit. And we've offered a peerage to so-and-so, so that And he's agreed to have a peerage. And so he'll give up his seat and all of these things going on. So they don't want to upset any of that. And they don't want to upset any of that at a national level or a local level. Otherwise, they could find that come the next election, their 22,000 majority is already dwindled to 2,000 before any account is taken of the swing against the Conservative Party, which looks almost inevitable now. So there are lots and lots of considerations like this. And what you don't want to do in these circumstances is annoy your constituency association more than you have to. And you know, given that the members of a constituency association will almost certainly, given the national voting figures, have voted for Truss, then what I thought was interesting about that YouGov poll is that 40% of Truss of people of Conservative members still thought she should stay. So there will be a lot of sympathy for her, and also I think there'll be a lot of personal sympathy for her. That you know, her personal position and how dreadful it must be for her.
Funny enough, I put a tweet out about that.
Not feeling a bit sorry for her, I found.
That,
sorry?
Absolutely. Sorry? That I put a I did a tweet on Monday, which was very much around the viciousness of the trolling that she seemed to be having, and whether that was really necessary. And you know, lots of people piled into me and said, "Oh, you know, would you have been saying the same thing if the leader was male?" And I'm pretty certain I did say the same thing about Boris, because it did seem to get incredibly personal. That there seemed to be an absence of any sense that these people are actually human beings, as opposed to just, you know, figureheads at the top.
With Boris Johnson, party. With Boris Johnson, surely that he does have an air of, you know, that he's much less vulnerable than Liz Truss. And I don't think this is a male-female thing.
But but that's the problem, is that the air of vulnerability was an illusion. That actually, I think he was one of the most vulnerable people that we've had as a prime minister, in terms of his need to have to feel that people were loyal to him, and to feel that he wasn't annoying people. I think that was a really...
And that people loved him.
Key characteristic
of
him.
In all its different ways, yeah.
Yeah, no, and actually, you know, he has been very, very, very supportive of mental health initiatives. And I can only think that that's because that comes from some aspect of personal experience. So I would have said the same thing about Boris, but I did say it about Liz, and I think I was quite worried about her on Monday when she disappeared from view and nobody really knew where she was. I mean, to go back to the William Ragg situation and the fact that you're picking up from your political analysis that the people are perhaps minded to wait a little bit. The problem with William Ragg breaking ranks, so to speak, and he's not the first one. I think he's probably number six, five or six, to have publicly announced that he's
got, his seat is marginal. In fact, I used to live there. In fact, he went to the same primary school as me, but 30 years after me. in Hazel Grove, and the Liberal Democrats will almost certainly win that seat at the next election. So he's got that to be to take.
Yeah, so he's,
unless the boundaries work his way. Yeah.
He's vulnerable in another way. But my observation is that human beings are incredibly imitative creatures. And therefore, if you are a Conservative MP and you start to see a slow trickle of people putting their head above the parapet and saying, "I just put a letter in," will that actually overtake events? For all that people want to have a 2-week period of calming down and let's wait for Jeremy Hunt's statement, are we actually going to be overtaken by events, Dibboy?
Well, possibly, but you remember the rules are that it doesn't matter how many letters go in, she should be safe for 12 months, and the 15% rule only kicks in after she's been in for 12 months. Now, apparently there's been more than 100 letters gone in, so that's way over the 15%. And normally what we've seen in previous elections is that the number of letters that go in is about twice the number that we know about publicly. Now here the figures are very different. We're saying, you know, half a dozen we know about publicly, and there are 100 gone in. So that's another interesting aspect, that there are 94 people who've put in letters, but they don't want people to know about it. So that is an illustration of how they don't want to offend their conservative associations. And the party has got this, they've got to manage this what will effectively be a coup. It's going to be MPs saying, "Look, sorry, the members can't have a say next time. They messed it up. they've messed it up more than once, frankly. We're taking control. It's a coup. It's an MP's coup. Now they've got to think of a way of handling that and persuading the members to accept that, because you know they do actually need the members to go out and run their campaigns. I mean, there may not be many of them, but you know they do need a few dozen of them in each seat to go out and actually canvass and put out the leaflets and so on. And I think that will be a consideration. How do we explain this coup in without saying the members are stupid? Because that's the implication.
Because then you've got an echo of the Brexit
members
vote.
Are incapable. That's
right. You've got an echo of the Brexit vote where Remainers tried to imply that leavers didn't really know what they were voting for or didn't have the smarts to work it all out. And there may be quite in a Venn diagram of political loyalty, there might be quite an overlap between the Conservative membership that voted for Liz Truss and the Brexiteers, who might feel slighted twice over that they're.
Well, that's the other thing. Is it a coup by Remainers? And so what has got to be done is you've got to recruit to this cause of, you know, getting rid of Truss, having an election without the members. You've got to sign up a substantial, preferably a majority of MPs who are Brexit MPs. But it's terribly complicated as well, of course, because there were some MPs who switched to Liz Truss late on because they wanted to jump on the bandwagon. I mean, they look particularly stupid right now. I mean, Robert Buckland, the justice, the Welsh secretary, was justice, sitting on the front bench today, you know, one of the most left-wing ministers there is, a Sunak supporter. And then he switched right at the end because he saw, well, I thought it was because he saw which way the wind was blowing. And, he must be thinking, oh, what's going on? And they're all torn, and a lot of them will be thinking, look, maybe it's a good idea for us to go into opposition for it. Just sort ourselves out without the pressure of government. And a lot of them will be thinking, well, I'm going to lose my seat anyway. Perhaps I should retire. And of course, if they do make that decision, that makes them pretty unwhippable, because you've got, and the only way you can whip them is by, dangling the possibility of a or promising a peerage. So there's so many considerations here,
and we're all going to be watching it like the latest episode of some soap opera on Netflix. New viewers catch up here, but
well,
I think,
and of course it will be on Netflix one day as a drama as well. Bound to me, all of this,
and then you'll have John Major saying, "Oh no, you can't possibly do that because it hurts their feelings," as he's done with The Crown. Maybe it'll be even more glamour. Can you imagine? It'd be the Crown without the glamour. It would be intriguing.
Of course, the whole Thatcher drama in 1990, that was dramatised, and I think it's been dramatised more than once. But there you did have a central, you know, character, whereas here you've got Boris Johnson for a while, but then, of course, he's not involved really at all
Is there a historical precedent, a proper overlapping precedent of a coup?
Well, yes. The nearest to it is 2003. And this has never been properly written up, actually. And I did it a little bit in a book I wrote about Michael Howard. But Ian Duncan Smith was defenestrated by the Whip's office. He'd put David McLean in as chief whip, and McLean was basically turning a blind eye to members of his staff, his whips, MPs, going out and, you know, stirring things up against Ian Duncan Smith and putting enough letters in that there had to be a leadership election, and Ian Duncan Smith lost. But of course, that was all in opposition, and therefore a lot easier to handle. And then they agreed amongst themselves, basically. And in fact, David McLean was very close to Michael Howard, had worked with him at the Home Office. And it was agreed amongst Conservative MPs there would only be one contender, Michael Howard. It was what they called, everybody calls a coronation. There was no election for him. And by then, I think, and the other parallel was that by then, they didn't really expect to win the next election that would have been due about 2005. They'd reckon they had about 2 years before an election. But they put Howard in as the best hope of of, you know, clawing something back by the next election. And I think we're now into that territory of starting of Conservatives starting to say, look, the chances of us winning the next election are, you know, very, very small. And that therefore we've got to find the person and the policies that are going to, you know, at least retain a substantial number of MPs, keep the number of MPs in three figures, rather than reduce it to what the Canadian Conservatives were at one point, which was just two seats. Although eventually they did bounce back.
And things do go in cycles, but what you don't know is how long that cycle lasts. So what I've heard many Conservative MPs voicing is, as you say, that suspicion that maybe it would be better that they have a period of time in opposition, as if they themselves could dictate when they could decide to come back as leader. And that's not within their gift necessarily.
It isn't so, within their gift, but they will be thinking the economy is in such a dreadful state that Labour isn't really going to be able to make much of a difference, that Labour is going to be faced with spending cuts and not being able to do all the wonderful things that Labour governments traditionally do try and do, and all the government spending they try and do. And they'll be thinking, well, maybe it'll be like 1970 to 70, well, a reverse, actually, that Labour would only last one term and that they'll come back because Labour has annoyed all its supporters by failing to turn the economy around and raising taxes and all the things that the government's toying with right now. That there'll be that hope. I mean, Labour is, you know, and in the long term, historically, Labour isn't as good as the Conservatives at winning elections. But most governments get more than one term. But Labour governments tend to be shorter than Conservative ones.
And so on that final note, what's your gut feel about a general election? Are we likely to have one called before Christmas, or are we looking at the full term?
No, there won't be an election before. It'll be pretty much full term. I mean, it'll be, you know, I would say the autumn of 2024. I mean, the last it can be is January 2025. But I mean, to have an election now would be absolute madness. I mean, you know, you might as well just line the MPs up against a wall and shoot them all with a machine gun. I mean, there was no way they could. It would be. There's no way you could claw that back in a camp. In any case, what would the campaign say? You know, we're competent. Have chaos. What was the slogan against Miliband? You know, chaos under Labour. No. There won't be an. I mean, you know, in terms of fairness and the tide of history and so on. Of course, there should be an election now. I mean, the policies of the Conservatives won on in 2019 have long gone. And, we effectively have got a very radically new administration. And therefore, there ought to be an election. But it would be madness under the British system for the Prime Minister to call that. And she would go down as the least popular Conservative leader in the party's
history.
He or she, yes.
Michael Crick, thank you very much indeed for being my guest on the couch.
Thank you for having me.